Well, when I was invited by Michael Watson to be a respondent to Professor Elfdane, I just jumped at the honor because I so respect her work, and her book on sovereignty did not disappoint. And I also recognized that it was an opportunity for me to pay tribute to Robert George, who has been so formative to my own thinking and from whom I have benefited tremendously by his example as well as by his scholarship. And what I wanted to do is to look at the respects in which your scholarship shares points of commonality and difference. Among the things that attracted me to your topic is that you are focusing on sovereignty. And of course, as I teach in politics, that means, oh, goody, we're going to be studying power. And because power is what politics is generally understood to be. And those of us in politics understand that you can't get away from power. Power is very much a part of human life. The question is, how are you going to use it? Among the aspects of your book on sovereignty that I found tremendously instructive were the earlier chapters that dealt with a transformation in our conception of God among the early Christians, which had in fact crystallized then throughout the Enlightenment, that we have come to change our understanding of God from a triune God, a God of love, formed in relationships, three in one, to a God of command, a God of will. And that in large measure, our understanding of the state and authority is going to come from the ultimate authority, which is God. And we have seen this transformation over time from the earlier medieval period, certainly to today, where there is this understanding of the appropriate spheres of different kinds of authority, that there is a limited authority for that which is in the secular domain, and a space for the proper authority of that which is spiritual. And that idea of limited power being so essential to the Western tradition, and something that has oftentimes been forgotten, and forgotten at our detriment. I thought that that was a beautiful idea, and I very much appreciated how you took that idea of sovereignty, the sovereignty of God to the sovereignty of the state, applied then to the sovereign individual. Because, of course, today, if you ask what are the legitimate foundations of the state, very few people are going to make reference to God as being that which in any way legitimates the state. And indeed, this is one of the reasons why the Enlightenment has, in large measure, given rise to a crisis of authority. The question, what is the legitimate foundations of the state? What is the legitimate foundations of power? This is a pressing question. It is a question that has resulted in tremendous social dislocation. If we think of the 19th century and the revolutions that had resulted therefrom, in which we're trying to find legitimacy within us being a peoples, if we think of the rise of fascism or the rise of communism, in which we are trying to find legitimation for the state in some kind of secular ideology, in which, in a sense, we are deifying ourselves and it goes terribly wrong. This project to understand what are the limits of power, when is power properly employed, is something that's critical to the subject matter that I study. And I benefited from reading your work in that when students come to me, either with very modern or what they think are very ancient ideas, when they are either going to say that the legitimate foundations of government are going to be found simply in our consent, or simply in the idea even of the divine right of kings, which is also an idea of will, that you're motioning towards something, an understanding of legitimate power that is far more subtle than it being rooted in will, that power ultimately comes not simply from reason, but from our relationships that we have with one another, a sense of duty and a sense of obligation. And among the facets of Professor Elfstein's book that I found very beautiful was the emphasis that she had upon love, that we are created to love and to be loved. This is an idea that is something that's almost foreign to the discipline of politics, and your emphasis upon human imperfection, that much of that which in fact makes us lovable is the respects in which we are vulnerable, in which we are embedded in relationships with others, in which we come into the world with a kind of history that brings with it a sense then of who we are and the possibilities that are available to us, an acceptance of our own limitations rooted in love. Now, Professor Elfstein, being a very eminent political theorist among other of her accomplishments, I believe shares with me a profound understanding of the importance of your conception of human nature to a political project, that we have to understand ourselves to be beings of a certain kind, because politics is the study of man and communities and how it is that we are going to organize ourselves. And unless you understand what is the material of that discipline, then you're going to be totally lost. So all politics at root has a theory of human nature. And so I wanted, among other things, to suss out your theory of human nature, because that is where it has profound political implications. Now, one of the things that I found interesting in it is the differences of emphasis that existed in your book on sovereignty and in Professor George's book, Making Men Moral. Now, these are differences in emphasis. They're not absolute, but I think that they are important. One of the differences in emphasis is that Professor Elfstein, in her book on sovereignty, tends to focus upon love in relationships as a source of our limits. Professor George, as he is putting forth the conception of the human person, tends to rely on more of the classical, ancient conception of a person guided by reason, and practical reasonableness being that which is going to be that which sets limits to us. Again, this is a difference of emphasis. It's not an absolute difference, because of course, Professor George, when he is referring to practical reasonableness, he is reasoning within a tradition that understands the primacy of the human person. And primary among that is the injunction that we love one another. And so, in fact, that's taken as a first principle, perhaps sometimes unstated, from which the practical reasonableness ensues. So, too, with Professor Elfstein, although she is, in some sense, offering a criticism of reason, it's not reason per se, it is what she calls narrow rationalism. Which differs from reason insofar as we are using our reason to justify either our will or our desires, as opposed to thinking about those things that are limits outside of ourselves that we did not create. And I think that obviously the respect for reason that you share is quite apparent in your own scholarship, that you are presenting us with a very reasoned book about why it is that love ought to be that which imposes a limitation on us. So there is that difference in emphasis that exists in their respective works. What I think is perhaps a more important difference in emphasis in these works, however, is that in Professor Elfstein's conception of the human person, one gets a real sense of human imperfection, about the respects in which we are profoundly limited. We are limited beings. And that there is something to rejoice about in that as well, that that is part of who we are. Professor George, the emphasis is different, because the emphasis is more upon the respects in which we can be not made perfect, because none of us can be perfect, but it is a perfectionist ethos that he is putting forth. How is it that we can be made the very best that we can be if we have a proper kind of moral ecology to bring out the very best of our potential? Here is where I think that this has some significance. This idea of human imperfection, since I have left the Madison program, Robbie, I'm very sorry to say that I have encountered oh so much human imperfection that it has very much shaped the way that I see the world. I was very grateful when I was with you that it was wonderful. And but I have been immersed in a very imperfect world. And undoubtedly, that shapes how I see human beings. I share this understanding of deep human imperfection. But I think it's an imperfection that needs to be taken seriously to understand how deep goes our imperfection. An imperfection which you are speaking of when you talk about the human will to power and our need to tame that. That indeed, that drive for power, that is part of our nature. That too is part of what it is to be human. We are attracted to the good, it is true, but there is that constant human temptation that my will be done. And that has profound political implications. And what you're attempting to do, I believe, is to try to tame us, by noting that if we don't recognize how foolhardy that is, we're in for a big fall. And Ravi is trying to tame us by saying, let's try to tease out of that the very best of you. Let's orient your will in such a way that it is working productively toward that which is good and worthy of people. My problem, given the very imperfect world that I live within, and given my developing understanding of the depths of my own sinfulness and my own imperfection, is whether in our political science we have to make more room, not just for bringing out the best in us, not just talking about the good of relationships, but also to talk about, in frank ways, the worst of us, our sin, the depths indeed of our depravity in many ways, with pride being perhaps the worst of the sins that we are prone to. I mean, passions are garden variety sins. You know, that you give in to gluttony or sexual licentiousness. Pride, as C.S. Lewis had understood, that's the biggie. That's the one that comes closest to Satan. Well, these thoughts have been coming through my head, and I think that this idea of human imperfection does have profound political implications, and especially in constitutional law. And I think that it is something that the founders themselves understood very well. Because in constructing our government, it was not a government that was premised upon the very best of us. It was a government that was premised upon our very worst tendencies. The fact that we needed ambition to check ambition in Alexander Hamilton's words in Federalist Number 6, as he speaks of men being rapacious, vindictive, and ambitious. And for that reason, among others, of course, we needed to think through constitutional structures in which we would not give some kind of absolute power, but we were going to try to bring the worst of us into a kind of profitable use. I think there's much to be said for that. That is not in any way a refutation of Professor George's project, but I think that it leaves us with what seems at least a prima facie paradox. And it seems to me that a perfectionist ethos, if it's going to be truly something that is going to bring out the best in us, is going to need to be rooted in a constitutional structure that understands our deep human imperfection. Given that we cannot trust any mere mortal to have the kind of practical reasonableness consistently, that they're not going to submit to the will to power. And that is one respect in which I think that what you are putting forth, I'm sussing out something which I think is a valuable contribution. It doesn't contradict at all the perfectionist ethos, but I think that it does suggest something about the preconditions that are necessary within government for us to pass laws in which we might be able to bring out the very best in men. I'm going to just make one more point, and this is a point about which I have less confidence, but I'm going to throw it out there just for the sake of discussion, and you know, if it falls flat, that's fine. But as I'm thinking about human sin, my own sinfulness, the imperfections that I recognize exist within others, I have to wonder whether sin might have some value. Now, I know this seems like the sort of thing, how can sin possibly have value? If we are sinful beings, is it possible that sin might have some value? Now, obviously, in and of itself, it has absolutely no intrinsic value. It's evil. It seems to me that if we acknowledge the reality of sin and the reality of human sinfulness, it can have value insofar as it suggests the respects in which we are radically unlike God. And that is also an important limitation, that it is not simply our reasonableness and our capacity for love, which is important in our politics, but also an acknowledgement of those facets of human nature in which we are not godlike. And that it is through our sinfulness oftentimes that we come to know God. I'm reminded of C.S. Lewis in his Mere Christianity when he speaks of the necessity of trying to be perfect, that it is important that we try, that we make that effort. But what are we going to find out as we're trying? We're going to find out how bad we really are, how far from perfect we are, how far from being godlike is the condition of being a human being. And I think in that is an important lesson. It's an important lesson insofar as sin is instructive. I don't recommend that you go out and sin for the lesson, but I have some assurance, given your natures, that you will sin, whatever's said here. And that in sinning, at first you're going to deny the fact, as I do, that that's the case. But it is in exercising one's practical reasonableness, as Professor Wood George would say, that you'll come to an understanding of the respect in which, I have learned something about my own limits, about my own humanity. Now, of course, if you don't exercise your practical reasonableness in relation to sin, of course, it's not going to have a value. So I'm not saying sin has intrinsic value. But what I am asking for is that as we're thinking through the implications of our conception of the human person, that we think not simply about our reasonableness, our love, the best of that, which comes our resemblance to God, but that we make room in our politics for talking about the fullness of our imperfections and the respects in which we are radically unlike God. Thank you very much.